This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Of the many wounds that are going to need some attention this summer, one of the most pressing is Americans' loss of faith in a common purpose and common good. Journalist Nathan Bomey is a former Michigander who's written in the past about Detroit's bankruptcy. And he's back this month with a new take on how we talk to each other and pulling America back from the political brink. The book is called Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. Nathan's a former Detroit Free Press reporter who now works for USA Today. Nathan Bomey, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
Could you read to us from the very start of the book?
I'd love to. It starts like this. In many ways, America is like one big dysfunctional family that, despite its differences, is better off when it's communicating and cooperating effectively, even though we will never agree on everything. But lately, we've been emotionally abusing each other, failing to listen to one another, and exploiting each other's failings. The fact that we increasingly can't hold fruitful conversations with people who aren't like us, which is the key to finding common ground and thus achieving political, social, and cultural progress, illustrates the depths of our civic crisis. Productive discourse, in spite of our disagreements, is the archstone of democracy. It's what holds us together, according to David Blankenhorn, co-founder of Braver Angels, a nonprofit that teaches Americans from different backgrounds how to communicate. Conversation is the very heart and soul of self-government, Blankenhorn said. It's always been that way. You can't run a democracy without that.
I really love the metaphor for America as a dysfunctional family, because families definitely get into it, and yet they kind of can't get away from each other, which is where we all are right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we are a dysfunctional family because, you know, we are stuck in this sort of grand experiment together. And even if we wanted a divorce, we would still have to deal with each other. And, you know, David Blankenhorn at Braver Angels really argues that, you know, conflict is okay. He says, you know, we don't have to reach a consensus necessarily. We don't have to come to some sort of agreement on policy. That's actually not the goal of his group. The goal is to say, how do we deal with conflict? Because conflict is central to a democracy. And, you know, if we didn't have conflict, it would be an authoritarian government. And I find that to be such an interesting comparison because, yeah, no family can eliminate conflict. That's always going to be there. The question is, how do you address it?
Nathan, do you think it's true that we've forgotten how to talk to each other about the big issues? I mean, do you think this nation has ever known how to have that conversation?
Well, I think that's a really important question. You know, I don't want to be the person who looks back on some, you know, much better time in which we all got along. I think there's plenty of evidence that, you know, looking backward, we've always been pretty divided. But if you look at the data, it certainly suggests that the nature of our polarization has reached a new level. And what I mean by that is, you know, political scientists talk about what they call affective polarization, which is where you don't just disagree on the issues, you actually have a fundamental dislike and distrust of the other person as a human. And this leads to polls where it shows people believe the other side is evil or the other side is bigoted, and you simply will never even consider the possibility that the other side could have a point. And that's where we've gotten. You know, it's not just that we disagree on the issues, it's that we actually don't like each other as people. And when you don't care about the other person's humanity, that leads us to a much deeper problem than if you don't care about their opinion.
If this question is too personal, you don't have to answer it, but I wondered if you'd had experience with this within your own family.
You know, I'll tell you what that I've had experience with, not so much within my own family. I mean, I think everyone has family members they disagree with, so you can't get away from that. But I think what I personally experienced is seeing so much of it as a journalist, and I'm sure you know this as well, when you're immersed in a day-to-day job where you're dedicated to the facts and dedicated to reporting the truth, and yet you see that for so many people, the facts aren't relevant, or in some cases, they will blatantly skew them all together. together, it is kind of depressing. And so that's why I wrote this book, because I said, I can't accept the status quo. I've got to go and meet people who are trying to bring people together despite their differences, whether it's race, politics, religion, class, or culture. And I am encouraged to report that they're out there. I mean, I went and met them. This is even before COVID. I've been working on this since 2018, because I feel like, you know, this issue is always going to be relevant, but I have to say it feels more relevant today than it ever has.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a few people who wouldn't say that we do need a better understanding of each other. But at the same time, this can be a profoundly frightening subject. I mean, some people take the view that finding an understanding through conversation is basically ceding territory when it doesn't feel morally right. Like, what if you're talking to a family member who has an overtly racist worldview, or who doesn't believe that you should love who you love? And these feel like, you know, morally dangerous subjects. Where is square one in the situations where we find ourselves across the table from people who don't agree?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to say up front that, you know, there is no way we can tolerate hate. We can't tolerate exclusion, you know, and there is sometimes going to be conversations that we simply can't have. And that is something we have to accept, that sometimes the divides are too wide. You know, you can't build a bridge across an ocean. But I think what often is the case is that we tend to think that the divides, they look like oceans, but they're actually rivers. And so, you know, it's about how we approach it. And I think that what I would say is this, that oftentimes building bridges is not really so much about the other person. It's about you. And that if our destinies are interwoven with each other, then, you know, we can't progress unless we have tough conversations. And so we have to get to that point where we can have these hard conversations. Again, not, you know, we're never going to tolerate hate or things like that. But I think a lot of times there is room for perspective on some of these issues. And the question is, how can we engage in a productive way that still keeps us safe?
Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned in the course of researching this book about how those conversations start?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's interesting. I met a group called the National Conflict Resolution Center, and they, what they're doing is mediation in completely apolitical disputes. So things like when a marriage breaks down, or when a family has a dispute with a teenager, or when they actually have mediated disputes with inside the military and inside businesses. And I said, how do you, you know, when these disagreements and these disputes become so toxic, get people to start having just the very semblance of conversation? And they actually oftentimes try to sort of reorient people's perspective, and they try to start with something very, very small. They actually start, I hate to use the term, with an icebreaker, but that's kind of what they do. It's sort of they find something very small. I would throw out the idea of something like a shared childhood athletic idol or something, or say a toy you remember from your youth. Like, I remember Happy Meal toys, like, from my youth. They're a lot better than Happy Meal toys today, you know, and you can bond over something really small and stupid like that. But it's something small, and then you realize, oh, you know, there is some humanity in the person on the other side of the fence, and then they build from there. You can actually, you know, the journey of the thousand miles starts with a single step. It's small things oftentimes, and you're talking about people who are dealing with very difficult disagreements, and they actually start small.
Yeah. I appreciated the approaches that you outlined in the book. It does feel like the early stages might be the most straightforward, where you emphasize listening and not talking. Yeah. You know, learning when not to talk and figuring out what the other person is trying to tell you when they do talk. How would you describe, you know, a mid-range, like if you've gotten past the opening stages and you want to start approaching a subject, what does the intermediate level look like?
Well, I do think that listening is critical at all stages, and it's not just trying to hear what they say, it's trying to internalize it. And, you know, when you talk to the people who really are doing this on a day-to-day basis, they say that, you know, listening is actually not just about trying to invest in the other person's story. It's actually can be a selfish thing in a way, and that's okay, in the sense that if you have some sort of policy goal, for example, you want to achieve, or you have some sort of end objective in the end. You actually can't really reach that objective unless you first invest in the other person and understand what they want as well. Because a lot of people just want to be heard. They just want to be seen. They want to know that you have identified them. You see that they have a perspective, because when you show people that you're listening to them, then they're more likely to listen to you. That's what's so interesting about this, is that one of the big goals of listening is actually to be heard, you know, which is such an interesting dichotomy. So I think that that's one thing. And then I also think that how we go about the conversation, if we end up labeling people, slapping labels on people, then we betray their nuance, you know, and bridge builders choose nuance over caricature. And so they try to avoid labels wherever they can, because it's not oftentimes just going to generate a counterproductive response, because people are complicated. You know, you really can't put people in a box, even when it might first appear that you can.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Nathan Bomey. He's a reporter with USA Today, and his latest book is called Bridge Builders. Nathan, you spend a fair amount of ink in the book talking about America's racial divide and the fact that most people, and certainly most white people, don't really live and work and socialize with people of color in this country, people with radically different life experiences. And that's certainly true in Michigan. What did you want to say about that?
Well, you know, I think it's critical to understand that we still live in a segregated society. You know, it's not legally segregated in the sense that we don't live in a Jim Crow America anymore, but we do live in a society that's segregated, and not just by race. It's segregated by politics. It's segregated by wealth. You know, it's segregated now, of course, by geography, rural versus urban America, for example. And so, you know, the fundamental premise of this book is that if we don't form relationships with people who aren't like us, whether they look different, whether they pray differently, whether they think differently, then we won't be able to bridge these divides. Because if we just remain encamped in our tent, then we don't go out and form those relationships with people who aren't like us, then we won't be able to gain empathy for them. They won't gain empathy for us. We won't end up making any progress in this two-party system that demands that we work together.
This could be very thin ice for people of color who, I imagine, have found themselves over the past couple of years with an awful lot of white people who suddenly want to be better friends in their lives. Yeah. And want to hear about their experience, and can feel like their experience is being mined for someone else's benefit and understanding. Did you frame what you wrote about this with that in mind?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really important point. You know, as a white man myself, I have to, you know, approach this with care and understand that, of course, I can't understand the perspective of, you know, Black Americans and other people of color who have, in many cases, been, you know, suppressed for so long, and their voices have been suppressed. And so the way I sort of try to describe it here is that even in real life bridge building, I actually talk to like engineers and contractors for this book to understand like how do real life bridges get built. And they actually pointed out that you don't actually always build the bridge to meet in the middle. That sometimes the bridge actually gets built from one side of the ravine to the other side, which I find to be really interesting. And so I think that as, you know, white Americans, oftentimes we are in a position to have a voice or have, you know, some sort of power. And we have to now start using our voice to say, we're going to build a bridge to people who we can't expect to build a bridge toward us. Now, a lot of times you do see Black Americans who are doing that, and that's amazing. But it's like we can't expect them, because we've been the ones who have been putting them down for so long. And so I think it's really important to understand sometimes like we can't expect people to meet us halfway. We haven't earned that right.
Is it possible to have conversation when both sides don't agree on facts? I mean, I think that's at the heart of what we've been talking about in politics for the past 5 years, and maybe many of the other kinds of social divides that we're talking about.
Oh, I think it's a really crucial issue. And as you know, the book I wrote before this was actually on the age of misinformation and why people are so stuck in this, you know, world of alternative facts. And I think that it is one of the most challenging aspects of this, that if we can't agree that the sky is blue, then how can we address what ails the sky. You know, I mean, I think that it's a really significant problem. But I did talk to people who are trying to figure out how to work in within these parameters. And, you know, I think, again, it goes back to if you can form the relationship with somebody and you work a little bit more shoulder to shoulder with them instead of face to face, oftentimes that can lead you to getting onto the same page. And what I mean by that is if you've ever thought about how hard it is to have a face to face confrontation conversation versus how much easier it is when you're shoulder to shoulder, maybe you're taking a walk, or you're involved in a public service project together. You're doing something together that then allows you to say, let me show you how I see the world, and instead of telling you how I see the world. You know, and I think that that can actually be a very nuanced difference, but it can be very significant. And so the analogy I would make is this. You know, if you and I are watching a game in a stadium or an arena, and I'm on one side of the stadium, and I see the play unfold on the field, and the play looks a certain way to me. Like, to me, it looks like it had an outcome that I seem as pretty definitive. But the reality is that everyone in that stadium has a slightly different perspective. Now, the facts on the ground are what they are. You know, the play unfolded in a way that cannot be denied, but the perspective on the play can be different. So, you know, the only way for me to really see that, though, is if I come over to your side of the stadium and you show me what you saw. There has to be room for perspective, but again, there are some things where there's no room. You know, Donald Trump lost the election. There's no room for debate on that, you know, but there is room for debate on some other things.
You bring us into this whole discussion with the idea that the United States could benefit from something like family therapy. The farther I got into the book, the more I kept thinking, yeah, but the thing about therapy is sometimes families who go to therapy still break up or still don't talk to each other for years at a time. Do you think the conversation is different when we acknowledge that things are pretty close to the breaking point?
Yeah, I do. And I think that it's important to come into this conversation clear-eyed and understanding how devastating, you know, our divides really are. And, you know, but I also think that there is data out there that suggests that we may actually not be as divided as we think we are. Now, this is interesting. You know, perception is reality. So if we think we're divided, then we are. But if you actually look at the data, there's something called second order beliefs, which is essentially what people believe that other people believe. And when you look at that data, it shows that Americans actually don't really know what other people believe, and they oftentimes tend to exaggerate what they believe. So, for example, Republicans tend to think that Democrats are more pro-immigration than they are, and then Democrats tend to think that Republicans are more anti-immigration than they are. So it's like there actually is more agreement on that particular issue, for example, than we realize. But the problem is that because we're so polarized in this affective way, then we often tend to think that we demonize the other side and humiliate each other, and then that just leads to more and more disgust for the other side, and then we can't have an honest conversation about what we actually might have in common.
Nathan Bomey is the author of Bridge Builders, Bringing People Together in a Polarized Age. He is a Michigander, now employed by USA Today. Nathan, it's great talking to you. Thank you for the book, and thank you for speaking with us about it.
Thanks so much. It was a lot of fun.